Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. You may be noticing quite a few insects right now. Did they arrive earlier than you expected? Having any trouble with any particular types of insects or just some questions? I hope you'll give us a call or email us or go to my Facebook page, especially if you've got a photo. We can go online, take a look on our Facebook page, and maybe identify it. Oh, not maybe. We will identify it for you. Phil will, not me. We. I use the we. I shouldn't use the we.
Phil's good at making up names if he has to, so we'll get it identified.
We'll get it identified. And the Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@wpr.org. And I'll tell you what, spring.
Yeah.
Sprung and the insects came.
Well, two things I'd like to make mention of. This weekend, I went up to Chilton to the Ledgeview Nature Center. And as I was driving, I was noticing that there was some butterfly just zooming by all the time. And then on Sunday, I got a chance to study. We have a relatively good crop of red admiral butterflies.
Oh.
And that's one that spends the winter as an adult. And it'll be interesting. They lay their eggs on nettle. And so a couple, 3 weeks from now, you'll see these little black spiny caterpillars on nettle. And it's been about 4 or 5 years since we've had a big outbreak of those. And neat critter. So if people are seeing these black butterflies with a great big orange band in the forewings, that's what's up. The other one, it's Friday, I had the pleasure of Dr. Joe Piesman, who is the CDC Lyme expert, disease expert, was in our department and had both gave a great seminar, but had a chance to talk to Dr. Piesman just about Lyme disease and where things are going. And we talked a little bit about the theory of how the ticks got here, which was really neat. But yeah, I think the point is that ticks have been quite active for the last 6 weeks or so. And so anybody who's spending any time outdoors needs to take precautions. And, you know, one of the dynamics is the ticks are becoming far more prevalent on the eastern side of the state, you know, from Door County down to Racine. And so people, if you're out in the woods, please take care.
So that's something to think about. We had an email from David who says, I grew great tomatoes in high tunnels last summer. I usually closed up the tunnels at night, except for a few really warm nights. Shortly after one of those warm nights, I discovered several tomato hornworms. When do hawk moths lay their eggs? During the day or at night or in a few favored weeks of the year?
Mostly at night. And one of the possibilities, if you keep on growing the tomatoes in the same tunnel, is that they were in the soil waiting for you, because that's how they get through the winter, as these 3.5-inch long dark chestnut brown pupal cases. And it's interesting because I've already had a couple of those submitted as people have been digging the garden. They've dug them up. So typically they emerge in May and early June. And mate, and then the adults will come in and lay eggs. And from the time they lay eggs until the caterpillars are probably big enough for you to see is going to be a couple, 3 weeks. So, you know, again, depending on when the thing was open, but a couple of the scenarios were they were already in the ground. And so when they emerged, they were right there to lay their eggs. Or again, an adult came in, and we find that the adults can home in on these plants pretty well. The tomato and tobacco hornworms prefer solanaceous plants. So tobacco, tomato, peppers are all things that they would lay their eggs on.
We have Carol in Madison with a question for you. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I have a very odd situation. I think I heard over the radio on another program that there are insects that come in through your water in your sewer tanks, and I've been pipes, and I've been having some, well, not in the last few weeks, but winter, I've been having a lot of bugs coming up who have been in my toilet and in my sink, and I don't know if they just came from somewhere else and went to those places, or have they come up through the pipes.
Well,
is that possible that they could live in that situation?
There's only a couple critters that I expect more with drains than anything else. There's a couple flies that can breed in the slime in gump that collects in there. In fact, one is called a drain fly. Another one's called a forage fly. Other than that, no. You know, it turns out that porcelain is a great insect trap, so anything that's crawling through the bathroom that falls in the sink or the tub can't get out. So it gives the impression that a lot of things might be coming with the water from the drain but are not. So, You know, you catch a critter, I'd be happy to take a peek at it and, you know, see if we can come. But my first guess is that they're coming from somewhere else.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Again, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We're glad to talk with you. Ed, let's see here. I just went away from the comment I had here from Deb. Oh, here we go. Deb says, I'm not sure if it's early, but there were leeches on our canoe in Mirror Lake last weekend. Yikes.
Yeah, well, you know, the temperature models that we use for predicting insects, and I think people that are familiar with plants know we're about 4 to 5 weeks ahead of schedule. So it's the end of May. And so that part, you know, I think it all makes sense to me. And it will be interesting to see how this all plays out. I think for any of us, even though I've been in this business for almost 40 years, this is unprecedented. And if this continues, as I said, it's going to be, I think, a new experience as far as what to expect with insect activity.
More callers online. Again, the number 1-800-642-1234 if you'd like to join in. And we got Donna in Hartford. Let's go there. Hi, Donna. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I got a question for your guest. About 3 or 4 weeks ago, I noticed when I opened my dishwasher that I had these black ants crawling on the inside of my dishwasher.
Mm-hmm.
I had some dirty dishes in there from the night before. I ran it, and it was fine. But a couple of days later, I opened it again, and there are these black ants.
Yes.
And I'm wondering, how am I getting these in my house?
Well, they're carpenter ants, and those are workers, and they are very good if they can find a dependable food source to keep coming back. And believe it or not, it is not impossible to be able to weasel around through the walls and whatnot of a dishwasher and get access. Now, the question is the source of the ants a nest in the house, or are you just recruiting ants from outside? And it really is hard to tell. My guess is they're probably from outside. But again, it goes back to the point. This is the equivalent of just having a garbage can that has food scraps. They know the food's going to be there. They lay down chemical trails to communicate to other ants in the group to come back. So it would help to keep the dishes rinsed well so there's no food material for them to find. But if this continues, then the question is you know, I try to find the nest if possible, which can be kind of a bit of a detective work. So one of the games that is played here is if you spray along the outside foundation with an ant spray, you really repel the ants. They stop coming in. And okay. So if you know, if your concern is you just don't want black ants in the house, you can go to the hardware store and buy one of the registered ant materials and spray along the outside. And as I said, it's not as if you're wiping the ants out. They just come across this chemical barrier and they decide they don't want to come in. That will last for 4 or 6 weeks at least. Now, if you were to do that treatment and it didn't make a difference, that means the ants are already nesting inside. But if that was the case, I would think you'd see other signs of activity, you know, ants in the kid's bedroom. And, you know, sometimes you get sawdust coming out of the ceiling, which tells you where the ants are. So, like I said, just seeing a few ants in the kitchen is often, because that's where they find food, often just suggestive that you're drawing ants in from outside.
Okay. I thank you so much for your help, and I will definitely try that. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. We actually have some ants that turned up in our house this spring now, very small ants, and they like sweet. They had a little some syrup or something on the counter and right by the sink, and
sure.
They were coming up where the washboard or dashboard would essentially be behind the sink.
If this was the middle of the summer, it would be a little bit more difficult because there's more possibilities, but when we get into still late winter, early spring, when it's too cold for outside ant activity and we see something like that, my first guess is something called a pavement ant. This is a European species that in the last 10 to 15 years has decided that Wisconsin's a nice place to be. It's been moving this way for decades, but it's a smaller ant. It feeds both on proteins and fats. It's a little bit of a stinker. You know, when ants are invasive like this, we often refer to them as tramp ants, and to an entomologist, what that suggests is that they have multiple queens and multiple nests, which make them a bigger challenge to control. They do bait relatively well, but you have to be persistent because, again, you may be dealing with one colony in one part of the house, and they're typically in walls. They like hot water heat, although you can find them in houses that don't have that. So, as I said, that would be my first guess, and it is an ant that baits better than it does responding to sprays, because you often can't find where the nests are, and as I said, there usually are more than one nest involved. So, the main thing I tell people when you decide to go with baits, you don't necessarily have to identify the ant, but what you do have to pay attention to is their food preferences, because some baits are purely sugar-based, some are protein-based, some are combination, and that kind of matches the diet of different ants. And so make sure if they have a liking for something that when you buy a bait that it matches. And to be honest, the best baits, you probably have to go on the internet. There are baits that are formulated specifically for pavement ants and the like, but they're marketed more to pest control companies and the like. And so, as I said, you can't get all the available baits at the hardware store, but you can on the internet.
And Marlis in Cambridge, on to you now. Hi, Marlis.
Hi. Well, I guess it's the ant day today. I have, for the first time ever, after living in this house for over 30 years, we have black ants, and it sounds like the carpenter ants, they are about a half an inch long. And what I'm trying to understand is, what is it they are after? If it's sugar or if it's starches or what I should be... I've been throwing out things right and left trying to get rid of the food source. And
yeah, but see, I don't think... They feed both on sweets and protein. In fact, honestly, their main diet outdoors are insects. So whether it's sometimes it's oil, sometimes it's sweet, and it's good to try to keep things cleaned up, but I wouldn't necessarily throw food out. The problem, again, when you look at the colony, is you've got a few individual sterile females, which we refer to as workers, coming in, but the main colony is still actively breeding probably outside, and so this, again, takes this step back. What are my options? It does help sometimes, if people would prefer not to use chemicals, is to caulk and seal around openings and, you know, that interface between your siding and your foundation, because that's a place where things crawl up into. If you're going to use treatments, as we had talked about earlier, is that it doesn't really do that good to spray indoors, but if you spray along the outside, you create a barrier that they don't want to cross, and there's a number of products available there. Even mint oil works to a degree, although it doesn't last a long period of time in this repellency, so that stops them from coming in. What makes them difficult is they're more active at night, and so if you're doing detective work, you almost have to be out there with a flashlight more so than what you see during the day. But it all comes back to the more direct method of dealing with them is finding the nest and killing the single queen that's there. But if that's, you know, out in a tree and 10 feet high, it's going to take an awful lot of detective work to trail that back. But, you know, for now, as I said, keep the exposed food to a minimum. Keep dishware and glasses. I mean, even something like a little bit of juice spilled, if they find it, as I said, they'll get them in the habit of coming indoors.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Here we have a little shrimp critter that is on the Facebook page here, and we've got a video of it. And our person was wondering, our person who went online to my Facebook page was wondering if you know what that is.
Well, it's definitely a crustacean, and so not in the insect group. It is in that shrimp or isopod group. I just can't see the legs. You know, we have count legs and whatnot, but definitely an aquatic critter, that's probably the best I can give them from what it is.
All right. We gave it a try.
Technically, when you want to get a real specific identification, as I said, it comes down to having count legs, antennae, and other segments, and that's what makes it difficult, especially on a moving target sometimes.
Beverly in Rushford, on to you. Hi.
Yes, hi. Well, I've got some very energetic, large horseflies. They are not interested in food. They're only interested in being in my windows, and then at night they'll dive bomb me. And then they go back out the window. And the only way I can get rid of them is to keep swatting them.
Okay.
But they keep returning.
Not what I would call a horsefly. A horsefly is an outside biting creature that doesn't want to come indoors. What you're describing to me sounds like a large blowfly.
Okay.
And blowflies suggest that something, a squirrel, a bird or whatnot, died in your attic or somewhere similar. And now you're seeing the adult flies come off that carcass.
Ooh.
And so you know, if it was in your living space, you would have found it and cleaned it up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what makes this kind of difficult, because whether they're coming down through light fixtures or the like, and then they get all mixed up, and they're trying to get outside, and that's why they're going to the windows.
Mm-hmm.
And then at night, they'll be attracted to light. You know, so if you're sitting there reading and you got a light next to you, I expect them to come dive bombing in. Now, if the odor hasn't caught your attention, it's got to be small, and it will be a relatively short, you know, maybe going on for a week, 10 days, and then it will just disappear. That's my guess is what's going to happen. If it was something bigger, as I said, then the odor would catch your attention, and then if possible, you remove the food source. But as I said, I think it's in a wall or an attic space, and you're just kind of harvesting the problem. And sometimes I've even seen in chimneys. We had the problem with something died in the chimney, and then the flies kind of filter through and end up in the basement or elsewhere. But as I said, other than keeping your eyes open, I think it will run its course without doing anything.
Hmm. Well, it's a 100-year-old house, so I imagine there could be some pretty good things.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot for calling, Bev. Appreciate your call. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest, Michelle Good, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. Caller from Dane wondered about ticks. He's noticed about a 10-fold increase between this year and last. Any bird or animal that eats them, or anything he can do to control them?
Well, chickens and guinea hens, honestly.
Yeah,
the way they forage
really
will pick them up. Now, it depends where you're finding them. You know, it's one thing if they're in your yard. It's another thing if it's in the 10-acre woods that you have. Because, interesting enough, we know that leaf litter has a whole lot to do with their success and their numbers. So the more open, so really mowed lawn is not a good habitat for ticks. And the more litter you have, the better they do. Now, people have had, and again, when I was talking to Dr. Piesman about options, it's interesting out east with a large amount of Lyme disease and whatnot, 3/4 of the people do not feel comfortable with spraying insecticides. You know, I know this is a personal choice. You know, my personal opinion is, you know, Lyme disease is a serious issue. And you know, the pesticides, I think, if used correctly, don't pose a lot of risk. But people are looking for alternatives. They've even had luck with insecticidal soap. But it's not a spray you can put on with a backpack sprayer. You need a high-pressure, high-volume spray, so you're basically soaking and blowing the leaves off the ground. But even those treatments work, but I'm not so sure it's so practical. I mean, that's the problem. And so now if you're talking about treating in your lawn, what we suggest is where the lawn stops and the lawn grass or wood starts, that 10-foot-wide band all around the area is what's most effective to treat. You only have to treat once a year. Lots of options. The old garden insecticide 7 is registered. Permethrin is also active. Bifenthrin, which is in Bug Be Gone. Or, again, if you want to use the insecticidal soap, but I would put that on with one of these hose end attachments so you're drenching to get enough volume. Because what we find is if you treat the leaf litter and it only stays on the surface, you only kill 10% of what's there.
Wow.
So
there you go. Let's go to Mary in Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. About a month ago, I would wake up with these large red welts on my legs. Obviously, got bit by something. They itch like a mosquito bite, but they're large, and then they've got a red dot in the middle. And I'm just dying to find out what it is that's biting me in the night. I wonder if it's a spider or what that could be.
No, not a spider. So my first question with bites on the ankles, do you own pets?
Yes, but a dog.
Okay. I don't trust people who can diagnose it by the look of the bite, but where the bite is, when you get them, and then the pattern. And this is classic fleas. Cat fleas and dog fleas on people tend to bite in clusters on the ankles. They often itch like the dickens. It is an individual response. But if I had to give you a guess, with pets, even without pets, I've run into a couple cases with raccoons in a chimney where people are getting cat fleas and getting bit. But it sounds like to me that a flea had found you, and they would prefer to feed on the pets. So I would check. Are the dog usually treated for fleas?
Yes, I mean we've never had a problem with it before, but these go all the way up my legs on my midsection. Is there any other thing that could be doing it?
Well, if this is repeating and whatnot, I hate to go there, but my second choice would be bed bugs.
Really?
Oh.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and sometimes things present like insects that are not. I mean, this is the tough thing about, you know, it looks like a bite, but it isn't type of thing. You know, one of the other questions is if it came a day or two after working outside, could it be chiggers?
Right.
You know, I mean, it does, there are other scenarios, but, you know, if you get a repeated pattern of picking up more bites over time and, you know, you haven't been traveling or whatnot, you know, as I said, that would be the next place I would look.
Okay, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. And let's move to John in Bruce Crossing. Hi, John.
Hi, Larry. Hi, Phil. The other night, it was Saturday night, about 10 o'clock at night, I went out and looked at my deck through my window, through my sliding glass door. And I looked, and there are giant water bugs. There's probably, I don't know, I guess 15 of them. And I was just wondering if they bite, what kind of life cycle do they have? And
okay. Yeah, for some reason, I've had more pictures sent to me of giant water bugs this year than I remember. And, you know, what happens is that they typically will spend the winter in large bodies of water, and then the spring they will fly to ponds and other things. So they're flying at night, and they are strongly attracted to light. So they're also called electric light bugs by some people. But they're an aquatic insect. They're a predator. They feed on other insects and small fish. And if mishandled, they will give you a bite that will definitely get your attention. They don't go out of the way to bite you, but again, you try to keep your finger away from the front end of the beak because, as I said, they use that to capture 4 or 5 inch fish sometimes and feed on them. So you can imagine. Now, that number is pretty impressive. You must have a pretty strong light out in the back.
Yes, the light was on for a while, but I wasn't about to pick one of those things up.
Yeah, well, you can catch them from the back. I mean, they can't bend or whatnot, so they're easily picked up if you know what you're doing from the side and away from the head. You just keep away from the very front end of them. So.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And Janine in Green Bay, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
We have a cottage on the bay, and my one daughter sometimes has an issue with bites at night. Now, she's the only one that's had a problem, but usually nobody else sleeps in that bed. Could that be bed bugs?
Well, it could be, but, you know, there's a bed bug species associated with bats. There are mites associated with birds. As I said, it's all kinds of possibilities, but over what kind of time frame? Does this happen every year?
Well, I don't remember much of it last year, but I know there were a couple of years previous to that it did.
Yeah,
if
it was bed bugs, human bed bugs, over that period of time, the numbers would get high enough. There's no way you would mistake it. They don't kind of sit there and smolder. They kind of explode given the right circumstance. Mm-hmm. And you know, bed bugs is a big issue, but unless you brought used furniture in or people have been traveling and the like, I mean, you don't get bed bugs without having them physically brought into an environment.
So,
as I said, you hate to jump there all the time. I'm just kind of going back to my experience in the last 2 or 3 years where bed bugs have become so prevalent, and I'm dealing with a dozen cases a week type of thing. And it's interesting because sometimes in conversations with people, there's just no way we could expect where it was. And then over time, we find out, well, unfortunately, my son at school brought him in. Or, you know, it often comes, as I said, when you spend some time and think it through, you can almost point to the situation. Now, in apartments, it gets more difficult because they can migrate from your neighbors. But if you're in a single-family home and you've not been traveling and people haven't been visiting and you have not gotten huge furniture in the last 6 months, I don't think so.
No.
Well, she might have gone to Mexico. Could that be an issue?
Yes.
But then nobody else is.
Well, one of the problems with bed bugs is that in some people it takes 2 to as long as 10 to 14 days to show the bites. Mm-hmm. So the morning you wake up with bites doesn't necessarily mean you were bit the previous night. In Mexico, people traveling have a much higher risk of getting exposed to bed bugs.
I see.
Mm-hmm. There you
go. What about moth crystals? Are they dangerous for humans to inhale?
Well, yes. Naphthalene or paradichlorobenzene, there's two different kinds of moth crystals, and basically breathing a lot of it is not good for you, and to me is probably more hazardous and more personal exposure than using insecticides. It works fine in a confined environment, so you put them in a cedar chest and put them there so you're not breathing it, but if it's a constant odor to you, I don't think that's good for you.
Okay, thank you. Another question, what about lice? I had read to disturbing to get rid of them, just put a lot of oil on your hair and put a swimming cap or something on. Will that suffocate them?
Yeah, I mean, this is an interesting one. We've had trouble with head lice, especially in kids in the last 10 years, that a lot of the prescription and non-prescription products aren't working very well because the lice are resistant. One of the home remedies that seems to be very successful is using oils, things like olive oil or coconut oil, and what these are is a suffocant. But in order to suffocate the eggs and the lice, you have to leave it on for a number of hours. And so 8 to 10 is kind of what people shoot for. And, of course, the sour cap so they don't get everything all oily. It's interesting because, you know, I've had conversations with people who tried low-fat mayonnaise and it didn't work. Well, there's not enough oil content. Now, on the Internet, you'll have some people say that the oils don't work. It's interesting, though, I have yet to talk to a public health nurse or other people that have followed the program and whatnot and not had success. And there are other options. There is one I've heard last week on NPR, National Public Radio. They're talking to an entomologist who has designed basically a hair drying system that you put a cap on and you cook them out, which is much like the theory that we're using on bed bugs in some situations. So there are other ways of doing it, but you know, lice is another one of these things. You have to be exposed to them, you know, and so that's what happens in schools. It's, you know, one kid in the classroom gets it, whether they're sharing combs or, you know, hats, that kind of thing. It spreads, and, you know, because we're not looking for it, often it is found in a number of the children in the classroom before it's picked up.
Thank you very much for calling, Janine. Appreciate it. I want to give Wanda a chance in Tomahawk. Wanda, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Yes, I have just a real quick question. Just going back to the tick thing again, I was up at our cabin in Clam Lake, and we were sitting around.
Oh, nuts. Lost our caller. Call back. If you, we accidentally lost you here, so if you would please call back, we'll get you right on. Terry from Cuba City sends an email saying, I was seeing a few little white cabbage butterflies fluttering around back in March. Now I'm seeing more during our warmer days in April. Don't they normally migrate during the summer?
Not that species, but what's, again, fits the pattern of this year. My friend Les Fergie, who's a very good butterfly moth person, shared with me he had seen his first imported cabbage worm middle of March. It is absolutely a month earlier than any records we've ever had, and Les keeps track of these kind of things. So it shows you how out of sync things are. And now we're still seeing it. The warm weather, these were in pupal cases, and they have emerged. So if you have broccoli and cabbage, you know, normally you can get your spring crop through without having a lot of worm pressure. This year, I keep my eyes open because, again, these things have woken up early enough that I think there's a higher potential for having trouble in the spring crop.
Jim has seen some flying ants. He's been getting lots of the flying ants in his house this spring. They seem to be coming from the attic. They're the size of carpenter ants but have semi-transparent wings. They're easy to catch and attracted to the windows during the day and the lights at night.
Okay. They're carpenter ants. The wing color is not anything distinctive. Large black ants, you know, they are emerging or swarming basically 2 months early. And this is a strong indication of a well-established colony in the house. So now, you know, you can vacuum up the winged ants. They're not doing you any problem. They're just trying to get out. But if you could at all find where they're bubbling out from, that's the most important piece of evidence because that's where the nest is, and two squirts are rayed into the nest, and you're done. And so, you know, this kind of swarming activity, even though it's frustrating, really is very beneficial because if they're bubbling out of a windowsill, the nest is there. If they're bubbling out of a light fixture, they're up in the attic space somewhere. And so a little bit more detective work, and you should be able to get things taken care of. And as I said, with this particular kind of ant, there's only one queen. She's in the nest. If we kill her, they're done.
And now we're back to Wanda in Tomahawk, who we lost earlier. Wanda, hi. Thanks for calling back.
Yeah, not a problem. I apologize. I must have hit the end on my phone. But anyway, I was in Clam Lake. We have a cabin in Clam Lake, and we were having a bonfire. And we were, you know, ticks all of a sudden. You're pulling ticks off. Yeah, and we had a little jar. And we started putting all these ticks in this little jar. We had about 20 of them. Eventually, I was looking around on the ground, and here was a little caterpillar. I threw him in there, and the ticks started crawling on him. He ended up secreting something out, and within 5-10 minutes, we looked at that tick jar, and the ticks were all dead. I was just curious if is anybody doing or trying to find a natural way of, you know, getting rid of ticks? I mean, that caterpillar's fended off those ticks all by himself. Yeah.
Well, going back to my conversation with the gentleman from the CDC, there is an extract of the white cedar that grows up in Alaska that kills ticks. So it's a cedar oil, but it's a particular cedar oil. And Nucatana, I think, is the name given to it. And they're working with this product. So it's a natural product. It's very effective in ticks and other things. But, again, the application method to make it effective goes back to what we were talking about, is leading large volumes of water. So you're soaking it into the litter where the ticks are. The other thing is it's very expensive to produce. People find things, and some things really look quite appealing, but the economics is really what comes down to it. And again, an interesting point that he had, in fact, he said there are sociologists that are studying this now. In New England, or the Northeast, where Lyme disease is quite prevalent, they have found that the most people are willing to spray to protect themselves is $100. Which, again, I find very fascinating, because if you and your children have been had Lyme disease and whatnot, you would think that you'd be more aggressive, but it's just human nature, you know. Until we have the problem, we don't deal with it, and the like. And so that, what you know, all kinds of interesting novel ways of dealing with ticks, including bringing deer into bait piles and treating the deer so the ticks that get on the deer are killed. It takes some time, but that's effective. But again, it's very expensive, and of course, in Wisconsin, you can't bait deer in half the state, and so there's all these issues that you look into. People are looking at a lot of ways, but ever coming up with an easy way of doing this, I would be very reluctant to think we will.
Well, I was just thinking, you know, you find these caterpillars; they're like, you know, they're everywhere, and you can incubate insects to the point where, I mean, if this actually worked, I mean.
Right, but the cost then is raising the insects. I mean, you can tell right there the hand labor involved, the extracting of the chemicals and whatnot. Much like, as I said, you wouldn't think it's that complicated to cut down a few trees, extract the oils, and use it. But by the time you purify, go through all the processes, as I said, it becomes 20 times more expensive than the other treatments that are out there right now.
All right. Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Juana. Thank you for calling back. It was an interesting little experiment they did there.
Well, you know, and insects have all kinds of interesting chemicals that they use for their own natural defenses, so that it's not surprising. It'd be interesting to know exactly what species of caterpillar that was, because we have a few thousand in the state. But as I said, you know, observing that doesn't surprise me, but I really at the top don't know what species she was dealing with.
Back to bed bugs for a minute. Jeff from Madison sent an email. If you do have bed bugs, can you starve them to death by just going on vacation? And if so, how many days would you have to be gone?
A long, long vacation. We figure probably 6 months. So they're very resilient. There's some cases, and it depends on temperature and moisture, they can even last longer than that. So you can't starve them is the norm. That's unfortunate. I said they're very resilient animals. I mean, they're fascinating. And it's interesting because, you know, 15 years ago, I didn't know that much about bed bugs because they weren't that much of an issue. And right now, honestly, I tease sometimes when I'm out lecturing saying they're ruining my life. But it has become a very dominant subject and will continue to be, no question.
You can join in, by the way. If you have a question, call us at 1-800-642-1234. Have open lines to get you on pretty quickly. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question on my Facebook page, or maybe a photo as well of an insect we can try to identify. Just go to the Larry Mealer Show Facebook page and you can post a question or a photo there. We actually have a photo on the Facebook page. Kyla from Madison sent us a picture, Phil. She saw one of these in her house last spring. Thought it was a dragonfly, tried to move it outside. It curled up its body and stung her.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
They're ichneumonid wasps, and ichneumonids are by nature parasites of caterpillars and other insects. It looks like she might have a male and female here. The stinger is not a true stinger like you think of a bee that will give you a very serious. A true stingers are injecting venom and the like.
Yeah.
What these are egg-laying devices, and they use it to penetrate into the insect to lay their eggs. And so I could see where it'd be a little bit of a prick but really wouldn't expect anything more than that. And there are literally hundreds of species of ichneumonids. So I'm guessing a caterpillar or something crawled in the house. It had parasites in them, and then this is what emerged. And but not something you normally expect to breed indoors, because the critters that they attack are not indoor critters.
Very interesting. Annette in River Falls. Hello.
Hello. I am delighted to be able to ask you this question.
Good.
We have tent worms, and they have already started to make their tents. And so when we find them in our yard, if we can get to them, we cut them down and burn the whole thing. But I see them in ditches and in other people's trees, and I think, my word, people don't know how awful they are.
But they really aren't. I mean, there's two aspects to them. In the worst case scenario, if they're on your apple tree and there's enough tents, they eat all the leaves off, but by the end of June, the tree will leaf out again. So it's not a plant-killing type of insect. Now, the second problem when they're in those kind of high numbers, when they're done feeding, you got worms crawling all over the backyard for a couple weeks, and that's an mm-hmm. unpleasant thing, but nothing more than that. And so, as I said, it's interesting. There's a large number of other insects that don't make tents, do the same thing, and it doesn't get people's attention because it's not very visible. But tent caterpillars, you can be driving 60 miles an hour down the highway and you see it. They only attack flowering fruit trees, so that includes wild cherry and wild plum and those kind of things.
No.
There's only one generation a year, and it always hatches about the time the trees start to leaf out. They're active for 4 or 5 weeks. They transform into moths that lay eggs that will come out and hatch again next spring. And so that's kind of the general scheme of things. And it said once in a while you do get high numbers, and they do a lot of feeding. If it was my crab apple in the front of the house, I wouldn't want them to eat the leaves off, but it's definitely not going to kill the tree. And so you don't want to overreact to it. So, you know, I would suggest on your high-value ornamentals and fruit trees, you deal with them as best you can, but don't worry about the ones out in the woods.
Well, okay. But let me just tell you then my history. Years ago, when I was a child in northern Wisconsin, the tent worms came through and they stripped our birch trees. And they ate every green leaf.
But see, that's a different species.
Oh, it's not the same?
Right. The one that you're dealing with that makes the tents are called the eastern tent caterpillar. The ones that we have these incredible outbreaks every 5 to 20 years up north is called the forest tent caterpillar. And one of the things you can tell is the diet is the forest tent caterpillar feeds on oaks, aspen, birch, so a wide variety of trees. But they don't make a tent, interesting enough. And they're very, I mean, they're the first cousins of the eastern tent caterpillar. But I could tell right away, both from how intense the experience was for you and when you said birch trees, that it was a different species.
Okay.
There you go.
Thank you. That's great to know that information.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Shayla sent us a Facebook comment. We just applied the Milky Spore bacteria to our lawn to control Japanese beetles on Sunday night, right before the big rain. I've read other places that fall is the best time to treat, but is spring also a good time, given the larvae are probably out right now in Wisconsin? Also, should we expect to see any control this year?
The good thing about the spores of Milky Spore is they are extremely resilient. They last a long time, and they self-sustain in that when they infect larvae, the larvae get a large infection, and then they make literally hundreds of thousands of more spores. So over time, you build up the inoculum in the environment. One of the problems, so there's two problems. We always warn people that when things are feeding on your raspberries and the like, that most of the time the Japanese beetles that are bothering you are flying in from down the road. So you do not expect to relieve your plant problems by treating your lawn. What you're doing is treating your lawn to prevent grub problems. So the spores will last a long period. The grubs will be there. You know, they're somewhat seasonal. So probably not a lot of feeding going on this spring. And that's why they talk about the fall application, is that the grubs are more likely to get exposed. But the spores should be there for the grubs that will hatch from the adults that are being laid, the eggs that are going to be laid in July and early August, And then when the grubs start feeding in the late summer, they will pick up the spores. So, and the rain was probably a good thing. If anything, it probably drove the spores down and the like. And
or so it could do some good.
We'll see. And Shella is an old friend. So, hi.
She's an entomology graduate.
Yes, yes.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, Larry Mueller here. Let's go to Adele in Mesa Mani, who has a question. Hi, Adele.
Good morning, Larry and Phil. We just got back from the Dominican Republic, Punta Cana. And after we got back, the wife had some bug bites on her legs. And we went to the urgent care, and they said these are sand flea bites. Mm-hmm. And my question to Phil was, is there any preventing measure so next time we go, do you rub something on your leg or
sure.
do you wash yourself or what do you do to prevent it from next? And what are sand fleas?
They're not sand fleas. They're sand flies, to be
sand
honest.
Flies.
And so they're little
okay.
tiny gnats and typically active at dusk and dawn when the wind speeds are down. And they're a little biting gnat. And the bite honestly doesn't cause a lot of irritation, but the salivary components that they leave behind is what your body reacts to. And so severe itching, weeping, people talk 3 or 4 weeks worth of misery, they do respond to repellents. And so the two things is, whether wearing, long sleeve shirts and whatnot when it starts to get to be dusk and the like, also staying out in areas where there's a lot of wind and away from vegetation tends to be a less likely place to run into them. But the various creams and repellents, that we use against mosquitoes would work against these. The problem, again, goes back to people just aren't aware it's there, and it kind of catches your attention after it's happened. And as I said, so if you're going back into an area that has activity, that's what I would recommend is consider one of the repellents in cream, sprays, whatever, and apply it daily when you're outdoors. It's not a critter that comes indoors. You have to be exposed to it outside.
Mm-hmm.
Phil, do they live in the sand or what?
No, and it's really kind of a misnomer because they honestly breed in swamps and that interface of kind of mucky mud that you get when you've got puddles and the like. And then the flies come out, and they're very small gnats, half the size of a fruit fly, very weak flyers, but voracious in the way they bite. And again, what they're doing is a multiple stabbing, and then they are feeding on the body fluids, but when they're doing this, they're injecting the saliva, and that's what people react to. And so typically, legs and arms is where you get a lot of the bites. And as I said, it often takes 3 or 4 days to present, and so you might even be far away from the area that you're exposed. We do have them up here in Wisconsin, not near as common as they are down in more tropical climates.
Hmm. Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And on to Renata in Lake Tomahawk. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. My question to your guest is about boric acid. I have been using boric acid for the perimeter of our house just to keep little bugs like ants and other little creatures away. So far it's been working, but I was wondering, are there any dangers to other little animals like birds? And also, we feed our hummingbirds, and the sugar water a lot of time drips down on the deck. So what I have been doing is I put a plate of water with soap in it, and that seems to deter the ants from going in there. But my main question was the boric acid, what he thought of that.
Boric acid is a stomach poison. So even in humans, to be honest, if you ingest boric acid, it causes liver problems. So the whole idea is not to eat it. And I'll tell you, boric acid, when it's put in an ant bait, is very effective. Boric acid as a crystal, honestly, isn't that good. We know that in high enough concentrations, it can be a repellent. But my concern would be boric acid along the outside, when it's exposed to water and whatnot, will basically dissipate and go away. And so I think it has somewhat limited uses. And honestly, you've got to also be careful as borates, if built up enough, are plant toxins. Even though plants use it in low levels as a nutrient, it can be toxic. That's why, when they use the 20 mutein borax to kill, some of the weeds, people got to be careful because you can kill things. So I would consider other things. As I said, I'm very comfortable with using boric acid as an ant poison. It's a good cockroach bait. The reason it works against cockroaches is when you use the boric acid dust, when they crawl through it, they get the tiny crystals on their body, and when they clean themselves or preen themselves like a cat, that's how they ingest it. That's why when you're using crystal boric acid against ants, as I said, they're not eating it. They're liquid feeders, and so it doesn't work well there. The only place I've seen it work well is when boric acid dust is blown into a wall that has an ant nest. If it's in a concentrated enough form, the ants don't like it, and then they'll leave. But that's a dry environment.
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate your input on that.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. And let's turn to Ron in Manitowoc next. Hi, Ron.
Hi. I have a question here. We were kayaking on the Pike River, and this is whitewater kayaking. You're fairly covered up with helmets and things. One of the kayakers in the group only had bare forearms. We ran into horseflies on that river, and the guy with the bare forearms was just tormented by these horseflies to no end. I mean, it almost looked like a cartoon when you'd see them up ahead of you on the river. You could see this cloud of the biggest horseflies I have ever seen. And I don't understand what it was that drew him to that one particular person and left everybody else in the group alone.
Well, the first thing, and this probably doesn't, because everybody would do it, the more you move and whatnot, they are attracted to movement. I have noticed that, you know, when you go swimming and you come up and you have shiny skin, they seem to know exactly where that is. And I wonder if it was just the sheen of his skin was attractant, whereas people that had covering and other, you know, things,
right,
the color that presented wasn't quite the same. So that would be my first guess. And then once he starts to fight the fight, you know, and swatting them and whatnot, that only, again, aggravates the problem because all that activity just attracts more.
Squashing the bugs, because when he would swat them, he would kill two and three at a time. Does the chemicals from the body of the insects killed attract them?
No.
Okay.
They're very visual. It's a quick hit and run. The bigger you are, the darker clothing is somewhat more attractive. Interesting enough. Also, some of the lighter middle blues are very attractive to deer flies in particular. So there are a couple other things, but as I said, I worry more about movement, and that's why they also don't respond very well to the repellents, because they're not there long enough. It's just a quick hit-and-stab type of feeding, and whereas a mosquito and other things are kind of hovering as they're coming into you, and that's why the repellents tend to be more effective.
Thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And Don in Antioch, Illinois. Hi, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Easter afternoon, Sunday afternoon, I took my dog, little black dog, this weighs about 14 pounds, out into a different forest preserve. It was more of a field, and he liked to run in the grass and what have you. And he ended up with a bunch of little reddish ticks, maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter or smaller, and they had about 15 or 20 on them, and they were getting on us when we were in a car. And we took him to the vet the next day, and he said they were deer ticks. Now, I've encountered brown ticks before where I've had them on my body and heads embedded and what have you, but I've never seen anything this small. Can they also live without a host if they got in the house? Will they live long? And what can I do to get rid of them if there are any left?
Well, the interesting thing about ticks is once they start to feed and whatnot, unlike mosquitoes, they're kind of tied into the host, and so they can't hit and run. So the ones you find on the dog, they're attached yet, they're away. But they, not just the dog. I see when people go camping quite often, they can get ticks on their camping equipment. We put it in the garage, and all of a sudden, a day or two later, you find a tick there looking for something to feed on. They can't breed in that environment, but they can live for quite an extended period of time. But generally speaking, I don't expect people to bring large numbers of ticks on their person or on their pets into the house, and then those things take over. So I think the precaution here would be is if you take your dog out into an area that is got a lot of ticks, you make sure the dog is treated with, the various topical types of materials. What's important is that, the ticks don't die instantly, but they will die in a relatively short period of time. And even if you were unfortunate enough for a tick to get on your person and try to start to feed, it could not feed long enough in order to transmit any diseases. And if it had been exposed to the various products that you can put on the dog. So as I said, to me, that would be the solution.
Okay, now getting them off, I go back to Boy Scouts, Joe. Is that a lit match or something to get the tick, you know, get it?
Yeah, some research at Ohio State a few years back tells us that it doesn't aid to use fire, Vaseline, anything. It's just slow and steady. There are special, I know Sandy Sawchuk talks mm-hmm. about her tick remover. There are little devices you can pick up sometimes both at the vets and in the like, and probably some sporting goods stores. They're kind of like little forks that aid in getting down underneath and pulling out, and that probably is the best way to do it. If you're mm-hmm. you're an outdoor person, you get exposed to a lot of ticks, is just get one of these little devices, and it'll make your life a lot easier.
Yeah, she uses it. It's like a keychain. She's got it on her keychain, and I think she might have bought it at a Mounds pet store. But I'll bet any of the pet stores might have them. They look a little bit like the golfing device that you use to fix ball marks or divots.
The vet used a thing, probably what you're talking about, called a tick key.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. With the warmer temperatures, there's more insect activity going on outdoors, but that doesn't mean some aren't getting indoors as well. Sometimes it's hard to know what's cause for concern and what's just an inconvenience. Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're lucky to have entomologist Phil Pelletieri here until 12:30 to talk about that fascinating world of insects. He's got lots of great information to share. And he'll answer your questions as well. Is there an insect you want to learn more about? Join in. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post a question or even a photo. We've had a few of those already on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you click like while you're at the Facebook page, we'll send you regular updates on our upcoming shows. Stay with us, back with Phil in just a couple of minutes. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, about the world of insects. Join in with your questions and comments. We'd love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234. Lines are all filled now, but we'll have an opening here in a minute or two after we talk with Jerry in Platteville. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you. My wife was outside the other night, and she said she saw some grasshoppers coming out of the ground. This time of the year, is that possible?
Yeah, were they real little grasshoppers or bigger?
Yes, little green and brown grasshoppers.
Okay. Well, you know, most species overwinter as eggs, and they hatch when the soil warms. And so in a normal year, that's the first week of June. As we know, things aren't normal. So especially on a lighter soil, that wouldn't surprise me at all. And the other thing is that we do have some species of grasshoppers that overwinter as half-grown, the post-oak grasshopper. In fact, I had somebody last week send me a picture of one that was feeding on garlic mustard.
Huh.
So that was exciting, although unfortunately they won't eat enough garlic mustard to make a difference. But, yeah, if there were little ones coming out, I think you just had egg hatch. And, you know, I think the soils are warm enough, you know, with so little frost and what's been going on, that, yes, I bet you that's what you saw.
Yeah, I couldn't hardly believe it, because you always associate grasshoppers with the middle of the summer.
Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, that does, again, it's just another thing that proves how crazy things are out there with all the heat that we had early.
Yeah, thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Ernest in Vernon County, hi.
Gentlemen, I got two questions, and I'm sorry if they've been covered. I just got in the house. The first one would be, Phil, I talked with you near the end of the garden show on Saturday, and after I left you, I went over and there was a display of butterflies that were in frames. They looked kind of fake to me. They said they were from a butterfly farm. Could you speak to that?
Sure. You know, not as much in the U.S., but in other countries, people collect butterflies like you collect stamps. And with all these incredible tropical butterflies, honestly, it's become a business. And it's really economically very good to have this option in some of these countries where they raise butterflies. But, of course, people want perfect specimens. And so what you will see here, if you look at some of these closely, they've clipped the abdomens off of these things so that the grease in the abdomens won't affect the wing color. The other thing, I guess, that I would somewhat disagree with their advertising is they said all these butterflies died naturally. There's no way, because if butterflies die naturally, usually their wings are all beat up and whatnot. And so naturally might mean freezing or carbon dioxide or something else. And the other thing is we're even seeing to some degree these butterflies are sold as live pupal cases. And so, you know, here in Madison, Ober Gardens has a butterfly show just about every summer, and they pay for some of these exotic tropical butterflies to come in the pupal case. So you get to see the kind of butterflies you'd see in Costa Rica or whatnot flying inside the conservancy there. And so, you know, it's been argued in some countries where there are very rare butterflies like Indonesia that this is a good argument for the local people to preserve the jungles, because without the host plants that these things feed on, there would be no butterflies. And that's why if you can make them economically important to the people, there's a reason. And so, as I said, they are raised, and depending on the butterfly species you're talking about, in countries. And then these are the specimens that are sold. As I said, the one misleading part about that display is that I guarantee you that those exotic butterflies that they have, as I said, were killed shortly after they came out of their chrysalises so that they could be mounted and then displayed as they are.
Okay. They looked almost like paper with a kind of a fake abdomen to me. But on to the second question. Snow fleas have always fascinated me, jumping around on the snow at temperatures of near freezing. And this year I was rotating the tires on a truck out in the gravel yard here, and I found them on the gravel jumping around. Could you speak about snow fleas?
Yeah, I mean, technically, they're not a flea. And the dark-bodied ones that come out in February, March, April are often referred to as snow fleas, but the group of insects are referred to as springtails. In fact, some entomologists argue these are not true insects. They're a separate group. They're very primitive. But large numbers of species in the soil feed on organic matter. You also see some species in ponds. They like things very wet. In particular, many species have a little fork-like device on their abdomen that they can push off from, and that allows them to jump, and so hence the name snow flea. But it turns out that not all springtails are springed. Some can only crawl. Very common in garden soil. Again, generally one would argue probably beneficial because they're probably recycling nutrients. In certain times, you get large emergences, and that's what happens with the dark-bodied species in the late winter and early spring. And the dark body, I think, is really very important because, you know, we normally talk about insects not being active at temperatures below 50 degrees. But being dark bodied, if they can get out in a sunny area, they can heat their body up. And then once they become active, they generate a little amount of heat. And so they can be active at temperatures that are really quite cool at times. The other thing is they're so light bodied, you'll often see they'll blow into an area. And so you can see them an inch or two deep next to a trunk of a tree or a side of a building. And again, they could have blown away in from a good distance away. So just because they're congregated in one area doesn't mean they all emerge from the soil in that one given area.
Thank you much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. And let's turn to Jessica next in River Falls. Hi, Jess. Are you there? I think we lost Jessica. Well, we have Sue has was on my Facebook page and says, not exactly on topic. I think it is, though. Phil wonders about, or she wonders if you would comment about bees that pollinate but don't make honey. I'd be interested in having some hives, but I'm not so interested in taking care of the honey.
Well, it's interesting because there are literally hundreds of species that fit that category, but what we have to differentiate here is most of the bees that we have are solitary bees. So that means an individual female collects pollen. She'll put it in some kind of protected environment, lay her egg, and she has nothing left to do with it. The young raise themselves. And so these are very important native pollinators. When you talk about colony bees, ones that you have a queen and workers, there's only two. There is the bumblebees, of which we have a number of species, and the honeybee. So the native pollinators are out there. You know, there's a lot of interest now in native pollinators. In fact, a great place to get some good background, the Xerxes Society, which is a group that is dedicated to the preservation of invertebrates, big on butterflies, but they're very big into native pollinators. And if you go to their site now, lots of good information on how to track native pollinators, how to manipulate the environment in their favor, and the like. There's things like mason bees where you can use little straw-like devices that they will utilize. And so, again, it's kind of like having a colony, but technically it's not a true colony. So that's the group I think you'd want to look into. Some of them are soil nesters. Some of them you can just drill in the side of a big log and provide the kind of habitat they need. But honeybees are always producing honey. And one way or another, they have to be dealt with. And, you know, honeybees are rather labor-intensive, you know, with all the diseases and mite problems and whatnot. That's what's changed that group. It's a great experience, but it takes a lot more dedication and investment than it would be for working with some of these native pollinators.
Richard in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi.
Hi, Larry.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have some questions about chiggers, which never bothered me until about 3 years ago. But I get these mosquito-like bites, which seem to itch for about the following 3 weeks. And my question is, what's the best way to prevent them, and what's the best way to deal with the bites?
Okay. Chiggers are really a mite, and they are a mite that is associated as an insect parasite, at least in some life stages that they have. And so the first thing is, when a chigger starts to feed on a person, we're not a host that they like. And so, honestly, they feed for a while, and then they back out, and they're gone before you react to them. What's classic about chigger bites is they're usually in places where the clothing is confined. So the sock line, the waistline, for women often, you know, if they're wearing a bra, it's right underneath the bra. And a characteristic that it may take a day or two to present, but it often itches, weeps, and again, a lot of irritation. But the critter's already gone. So you get exposed to them outside. They're never an indoor creature. They are repelled by the common mosquito repellents. The permethrin type of tick sprays also work, as does sulfur dust. Sulfur dust has been used as a miticide in a chigger product for really decades. So that is an option. The other thing is, when you're out in an area that you're exposed to them, you come in, you take a quick shower and a good toweling off, and what you're doing is dislodging the mites before they get on your person. Now, it's hard for me to speak to on your, once it's on you and causing a reaction, that's a medical problem. But I think normally, you know, the kinds of Benadryls and whatnot, things that tend to settle down. And you can always talk to your pharmacist again about those kind of things. But you're basically trying to quiet your body's reaction to the salivary components that chiggers have left behind.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Spent some time in Nicaragua, and man, I just...
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, you get the wrong place at the wrong time, and it is an experience you won't forget, because as he had mentioned, it often just takes 2 or 3 weeks to settle down, and constant itching, and of course, then you're always prone to infections and other things. It's just a very unpleasant experience.
We have a call from John in Mequon. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a problem of... supposed insect infiltration to my basement, and what I'm observing is that in the basement on a wall, right where the frame meets the poured concrete wall of the basement, up there by the wood, I'm seeing a collection of powdery substances. It looks like coffee grounds, but they're real small particles of black and white, or red, or black and brown. And coming from small holes, small, very small, the size of a tine, maybe of a fork. And I noticed it last, say, November. I swept it away. It stopped all winter, but all of a sudden, of course, it's gotten warmer, and I'm seeing a collection again in several spots of this ground material.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have some ants, which I don't see evidence, no ants in the house, but something living in maybe the outside frame or in my wood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my first guess is ants from the way you describe it. I mean, there are some wood borers that we get, but typically they're not in the kind of softwood framing lumber that we have, and the other things that usually need some very wet conditions for them to be happy. Whereas, you know, I'm not so sure, and you may be able to deduce this by looking with a little bit of a magnifying glass, is if the debris you're seeing are really soil particles that are getting pushed out, or are they parts of decayed wood that are getting pushed out? And again, it would speak to that if it's the decayed wood, the ants are living in wood that's already soft rotted or other problems. But this is the kind of evidence. I mean, if it's ants, you know where the nest is. And now the question is just getting the spray to them. It may help in this case to get one of those little red, I call them WD-40 straws, but the little crack and crevice tools that you put on some of these sprayers that allow you to pin spray into those little seams and cracks and holes that you see. Also check along the outside foundation, because the ant nest might be there, and this is just a spillover. So it doesn't necessarily mean they're in the structural part of the house, but from the way it is, it's either pavement ants is my first guess. And there's a couple other ant species it could be, but that would be my first guess. And as I said, it should take care of itself pretty easy if you spray into that area.
Terrific. I'll try that this weekend.
All right, John. Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Steve in Sun Prairie, hello.
Well, going along with sprays,
yeah.
Can you give a ballpark answer as to the shelf life of the sprays that we can buy over the counter in the stores?
Interesting question.
Yeah,
because
it's a very good question.
Most of us have 2-3 year old
cans. It depends
on
if it are things frozen, are things heated to extremes. Those all would really shorten the shelf life. And normally, the products I'm pretty comfortable out to 3-4 years. After that point, you start to worry about degradation inside, and you know whether it degrades to products that are toxic to plants or not effective. And for that reason, you know, I always caution people, and we all succumb to this. It's the end of the summer, you're there, and there's this great deal. You can get 3 for the price of 1 of the gallon ant sprays, more than you need for 20 years. Don't buy it, because that's just way too much product, and you're just not going to utilize it. So as I said, I normally run 3 years. I'm comfortable. After that, I start to get nervous, might be a good way to put it.
Okay. In other words, if you see a can of ant spray on sale at the end of the summer, it would probably be good for the following season.
Yeah, there should be no problem at all. And you know, so there are some particular sprays that when you mix them with water, they degrade very quickly and whatnot. Mm-hmm. So that's a different story. But as I said, normally the stuff, if it's protected from temperature extremes and moisture, it's in good shape.
Gotcha. Thanks. You saved me a lot of money.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Linda sent an email. Oh, she had chiggers too. 17 bites. Or at least she woke up with, about 3 weeks ago, with incredible itching on her right backside. She'd been out in the perennial beds working under some white cedar trees. Would chiggers be the likely culprit there?
It would be the first place I would go.
Yeah.
And, you know, typically she asks how the bites look, and they often weep, you know, so you can see kind of a center punch mark, and that's really the feeding tube that the mite had set up. And then I think it's, again, as it gets irritated, it's body fluids that are exuding from it. You know, and one of the old home remedies was to get nail polish and put on it. And I don't know if it was the acetone that was supposed to settle it down, or some people misthought that you're suffocating the mites that are there. Well, they're already gone, and so you know that part of it doesn't really work. And but yeah, you know, and any time it started to be warm, you can expect to see them. Of course, you don't see them in the winter when there's snow on the ground. But you know, from this year, I'd say the 1st of March, they can get going. And it's interesting; you can often find them in the same areas year in, year out. Another place I find people running into them is wood piles. So when they're moving wood, to be honest, the mites can be there and then crawl onto you. In raspberry patches, for some fascinating reason. But again, you know, it's a moist environment, so I can see where critters could probably do pretty well in that setting. Whereas a dry, sandy area, you wouldn't expect chinkers. There's no plants. There's no insects. It, you know, you don't have the right components to get them going.
Gene in McQuanigo, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I'm curious about what I can do to help the butterflies. I'm already seeing swallowtails and this morning admirals and last week a morning cloak in addition to the usual cabbage whites. And I know that things are out of sync here. Their flowers aren't out. I mean, the ones that they normally feed on, and their larval plants aren't available. So what can we do?
Well, you know, that larval plants may be more of a problem. There's plenty of flowers out there. The red admirals are having a very good year. In fact, I just posted, Mike Maddox has helped me post some insect highlight stuff, and that's what I noticed, is just that the red admirals were flying everywhere this weekend.
Yep.
And
yep.
You'll see them on apples and flowering cherries and whatnot. So I think there's enough nectar sources. The plants are far enough advanced. Somebody was telling me that the monarchs are way ahead of schedule, which makes great sense because we've had so much southerly air flows, and so I know they're getting into areas. And so we're thinking about it. In our yard, to be honest, the butterfly weed is already up. I mean, which, again, is unheard of, but they're already up 4 or 5 inches.
Wow.
And so there's more plant material available out there than I think we know of. And so the same with the swallowtails. The insects and plant development really kind of coincide quite well. And so I think there may be more host plant material out there than we think. And as I said, I know there's plenty of flowers, so I'm not too nervous about that.
Okay, that's good.
All right, Jean. Thanks a lot for calling. And Norm in Wausau, hello.
Good afternoon. I'd like to ask Phil if he knows of what the latest thing is to prevent your raspberries from being eaten up by those dang Japanese beetles, and that you could put on safely so you could still use the berries.
Well, this one, again, is kind of a personal philosophy thing, but there is a systemic insecticide that has registration. It's the same chemical that we use on birch trees and other things, but it now has a fruit and vegetable label. And one of the reasons it can do this is it doesn't move very well into the reproductive parts. Now, this is also the same chemical that has been implicated as being a bee issue, although I will tell you that some of the recent articles have overextended, might be a good way of blaming colony collapse disorder on this chemical, and I don't think anybody working in that area could make that determination. It's a far more complicated subject. But so bare fruit and vegetable treatment, it's put on as a drench. If I remember right, there's a 14-day harvest restriction, so you've got to put it on in advance, but the chemical will go up in the leaves, and when the Japanese beetles feed on it, it will stop them. Another option is, at the garden show, I was talking to some people that were using basically floating row covers with quite good success.
Yeah.
Another thing would be interesting is we know that Japanese beetles don't like to come into areas, so things that are grown under tunnels, honestly. It doesn't necessarily have to be a tunnel all the way down to the ground, but if you're sheltering the top surface of the plants, so you're getting enough light flow to grow your plants, but yet you've got this physical barrier, you'll be surprised what a big difference it makes. So there are some times in your plantings you can make the physical adjustments, but as I said, the advantage of the systemic, it's one treatment, gets you through the whole season, whereas other chemicals we apply break down in 3 or 4 days, which means you often are applying them closer to when you harvest, which is the exact wrong direction you want to go. So, as I said, if you're inclined to use chemicals, I would look into that bear product as being an option.
Here you go. Thank you for calling. Mary in Lebanon, hello.
Hi. I'm outside looking at a caterpillar on my pussy willow, a very unusual one. I've never seen him before. He's very bumpy. He's got two yellow markings that look like standing up on his back. He's kind of green with white streaking, and I put a floating row cover around him last night because it got very cold. It froze here pretty hard. So I don't know what he can be at all, because I've tried looking on some caterpillars, but I've never seen one like this before. So.
Yeah, I tell you, if you can get a picture and send it to me, I can give you a better shot. It doesn't even have to be a caterpillar. It could be a sawfly, because they are worm-like larvae, and there's just so many possibilities. So I really need to see the exact patterns on its body. And there's quite a few things on pussy willow. How long is the critter?
Well, he's all curled around now. I would say he's, a good 3/4 to almost an inch long.
Okay, yeah. My first guess is it's a sawfly, but there are other critters that could be, and it seems a little advanced for this time of the year, but nothing surprises me this year. As I said, it's kind of crazy. But, if you could get a picture and email it to me, I think I can give you a better ID.
There you go. Thanks, Mary, for calling. Felicia in Hurley, hi.
Hello, thank you. This goes back to an earlier question. In Iron County, I don't know if it was 7 or 10 years ago, we had the trees all deforested. And was that gypsy moth?
That was forest tent caterpillar.
Oh, forest tent caterpillar.
That was the one the woman had talked about her experience as a young person is of it just eating everything in sight. And you had a major outbreak. It usually takes 2 or 3 years to settle down. And We have a little bit of an early warning because we can see the eggs on poplar in particular to see if the populations are building. And, you know, it's somewhat weather dependent, and but, you know, it can happen again, but I don't know of it being imminent is probably the best way of putting it.
All right, there we go. Thank you very much for calling. I wonder what we'll see in July for insects when we're in England. We'll be leading a group of WPR listeners to London to tour the English gardens and attend the Hampton Court Flower Show. We'll visit some of England's great churches and houses along with their gardens. And we still have, I don't know, three or four open spots yet. So go to WPR.org/travel, WPR.org/travel to find out more about this great trip. And Phil, thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri will be back in about a month, and we will do this all over again. And thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.